The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we begin on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with a special report headline, Aerial View. America's air carriers are using the pandemic as a once-in-a-generation opportunity to maximize their fleets and pile into popular markets. Here's what it means for the Triangle. The pages of this special report include a lot of graphs and a lot of detail on the information, but aside from that, there are three small articles that we'll read. The first one, Changes in Attitude, Changes in Latitude. What a long, strange trip it's been. That is, assuming you can still get there from here. The panic and shock that rocked the airline industry to its core in 2020 is fast giving way to one of the most explosive periods of growth and shifts in market share that America's air carriers have participated in for decades. Business destinations are out. Locales with sunnier dispositions are in. Globally, the number of U.S. flights to Canada, Europe, Asia, and regions of the South Pacific is in the doldrums, while routes to Mexico, the Caribbean, and regions of South America are at or above pre-pandemic levels. Parallels abound in the U.S. domestic market as a rush to warmer and more tourism-dominated destinations has helped offset an evisceration of flights that catered to business travelers. According to data from Cirium, a provider of airline research and analytics, some 916 domestic routes have disappeared since 2019's second quarter, equal to about 13% of all flights during that period. Not that Floridians would notice, as the number of flights to destinations in the Sunshine State is back to where it was in mid-2019, and passenger capacity, measured in scheduled seats, is up 6%. And our first full-length article in this special report is written by Cameron Snipes. The headline, RDU looks to warm locales as flights start to come back. Airports are seeking to capitalize on Americans being eager to travel as the pandemic recedes and vacations begin. There is no doubt that the COVID-19 pandemic hit airlines and airports hard. But as travel restrictions ease across the country, the travel and tourism industry is starting to battle back. And Raleigh-Durham International Airport wants to capitalize on that comeback, but the course the airport charts must be a calculated one. During a mid-May strategy meeting, Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority CEO Mike Landguth laid out the challenge. Today, the airport is serving just 58% of the traffic it was seeing in 2019. And business travel, which used to account for half of RDU's traffic, was down 77.7%, according to the airport. Data gathered by American City Business Journals show a large pocket of growth, though, for RDU from Q2 2019 through Q2 2021 in Florida. Cities in the Sunshine State garnered 5 of the top 11 spots in the number of seats gained in that time frame. Today, about 80% of the airport's traffic is leisure-oriented, Landguth noted, which is why the Florida growth is not surprising. Overall, those cities, Fort Lauderdale, Miami, Fort Myers, Jacksonville, and Fort Walton Beach, accounted for nearly 135,000 total seats in Q2 2021 and represented an increase of 33,740 seats from Q2 2019. The other cities among the largest gainers at RDU in Q2 2021 were Las Vegas, San Juan, Puerto Rico, and Phoenix. The top origin city with RDU as a destination in Q2 2021 was Atlanta, the same as Q2 2019, though the number of flights decreased by 349 and the number of seats by just over 45,000 during that time frame. Charlotte was the number two origin destination and actually added 9 flights and 1 seat from Q2 2019 to 2021. Atlanta was the only destination city with more than 1,000 flights from RDU in 2021, according to ACBJ data. In 2019, Chicago, Boston, Newark, and New York also had 1,000-plus flights at RDU. In fact, Chicago saw the biggest drop in total seats from 2019 to 2021, with a loss of nearly 80,000. The 5 busiest destinations from RDU in Quarter 2 2019 totaled 690,943 seats. In second quarter 2021, the top five totaled 518,369 seats, a 25% drop. Overall, RDU saw a 36.5% drop in the total number of seats during that span of time, according to ACBJ data. The leisure driver explains why Atlanta is still the most popular route out of RDU in June. With planned flights totaling more than 61,000 seats that month, Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport, a popular transfer hub for many travelers, was at the top of the list of busiest RDU routes for June, according to aviation firm OAG. The Atlanta numbers may be strong, but international numbers are non-existent from RDU as of June. Both Delta Airlines and American Airlines have no plans to launch their flights to Paris and London until late summer at the earliest, continuing a trend of delaying the return of flights. However, in mid-June, Air Canada confirmed its comeback plans for RDU. The airline says it will bring back its flights to Toronto and Montreal in early September. The plan is to launch three daily flights between Raleigh and Toronto and a fourth daily flight between Raleigh and Montreal, said Air Canada spokesman Peter Fitzpatrick. In the case of Delta, the nonstop flight from RDU to Paris is now tentatively scheduled to resume October 5, according to a spokesman. In the case of American's London flight, the earliest date that tickets are currently available for is August 17. More hope is on the horizon. The most recent data by ACBJ shows total flights in and out at RDU could be back to pre-pandemic levels by the fourth quarter of 2021. But that growth, tempered with the still lackluster business travel, has caused RDU execs to use caution when it comes to the capital improvements it has planned. But returning flights mean returning revenue for RDU and a renewed focus on capital spending. But it will take a while to get back to pre-pandemic levels after the stall, RDU says. When the pandemic struck, we didn't just tap the brakes. We went from a $130 million program down to $30 million, Landguth said about the budget for capital projects. Ron Kaposius, RDU's chief financial officer, told the Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority on June 17 that the airport had budgeted $39.4 million in capital project spending for the fiscal year that ended March 30. Of the $29.7 million in capital projects the airport did fund, the new international runway and airfield improvements to support the strip accounted for close to half of the funds. All we did was kick it down the runway, so to speak, Kaposius said. Obviously, we're going to be seeing increases in the next few years for capital projects that we had deferred. Meanwhile, mixed messages cloak the airline industry as every operator tries to find the optimum way to generate yield. For example, American has notified airports and public markets that it will be canceling hundreds of flights every day during the summer months to get a bigger hold on capacity, scheduling, and personnel management. Delta, however, notified its staff that it wants to add 1,000 new pilots by summer 2022. And the final article in the special report, America Takes Flight, headline, So, what did I miss? As airline travel surges back to pre-pandemic levels in some parts of the country, passengers encounter a world of stripped-down service and familiar faces. This is written by Evan Hoopfer. Rarely does an industry get to press the reset button, but that's exactly what airlines have spent the past 15 months doing. U.S. airlines, which for years were flying high off a strong domestic economy and social media-inspired wanderlust, saw over 90% of their customers disappear during the doldrums of March and April last year, when COVID-19 started to spread throughout the country. The ensuing turbulence was unprecedented as carriers shelled out millions to develop new cleaning processes and safety protocols on the fly while slashing unprofitable routes, but mostly they were just trying to survive. Having since navigated the worst of the crisis, carriers today are emerging from various degrees of shelter with eyes trained on growth. As of this month, domestic capacity measured in passenger seats was at 85% of pre-pandemic levels. This summer, millions of flyers will step on a plane for the first time since early 2020. What follows are five of the biggest industry changes they are likely to encounter as they prepare for takeoff. A leaner passenger experience. The most obvious changes to flying are the ones that have pervaded everyday life. Masks are still mandated. There's a greater emphasis on cleaning surfaces, and perks business travelers have grown accustomed to haven't returned, and it's unclear when they will. As if anyone needed any further proof of the lingering disruption, drink service in many first-class cabins hasn't been restored to full pre-pandemic levels yet. At Delta Airlines, efforts to reduce touch points affecting everything from food and beverages to the boarding and deplaning processes more or less remain in place to this day. Likewise, Southwest Airlines eliminated complimentary beverage coupons for certain business fares, while in-flight drink service remains temporarily suspended on most flights. Also, for those in business class, the airlines haven't all yet gone back to their legacy meal service options, says Jeff Pelletier, managing director of Airline Data Incorporated. Depending on the airline and the length of the flight, items like hot meals haven't been brought back, he says. The big fish are still swimming. Something worth noting isn't change at all. The major U.S. carriers are still flying. Rumors of their impending death proved greatly exaggerated and largely stemmed from a May 2020 television interview when the Boeing company CEO David Calhoun was asked whether he thought a major U.S. airline would go out of business. "Well, I don't want to get too predictive on that subject, but yes, most likely," Calhoun said on NBC's Today show. Some smaller U.S. airlines and several European carriers aren't around anymore, but the major domestic airlines are still standing. That's in large part thanks to the roughly $50 billion the industry received in payroll support program, or PSP, grants from the U.S. government that were dispersed with the explicit purpose of keeping employees on the payroll. "We've seen consolidation in the regional space," says Bob Mann, an industry analyst with consulting firm RW Mann & Company. "It's all about whether or not you were able to access PSP grants from the U.S. Treasury. If you were able to do that, you basically pulled through. Even some of the tertiary players pulled through." An opening for upstarts. The airline industry has high barriers to entry. Gate space is largely already accounted for, and jets can cost hundreds of millions of dollars. But this year, two new faces sprouted up. Having raised $83 million in venture backing from Peterson Partners and Sandlot Partners, Utah-based Breeze Airways has plans to fly to and from 16 U.S. destinations by July. The company was started by JetBlue Airways Corporation co-founder David Neilman and launched in May with rates starting at $39. That was a few weeks after Avelo, spelled A-V-E-L-O, Airlines began service with $19 flights between Burbank and Santa Rosa in California. It has since expanded primarily along the West Coast. Avelo, armed with a $125 million in startup capital and founded by former United Airlines Incorporated and Allegiant Air executive Andrew Levy, is seizing routes the major carriers don't offer, giving it a key competitive edge over Breeze, said Henry Hartfelt, an air travel expert and president of Atmosphere Research Group in San Francisco. "I'm more optimistic. Almost every airport that Breeze has announced is served either by Southwest Airlines, JetBlue, or one or more of the budget airlines," he says. At Southwest, it's business time. Speaking of Southwest, the Dallas-based carrier is preparing to thunder into the business traveler space, having spent the past year improving its technology to serve that market. In short, Southwest expanded its use of the industry's global distribution system network, a group of privately owned and managed computer systems that enable service providers such as airlines, hotels, and car rentals to book business class customers. For Southwest, it's also an opening to compete head-on for business class travelers with the dominant players in the sector, United, American Airlines, and Delta. For decades, Southwest has been the proverbial boogeyman of the airline industry, rolling out routes with relatively low fares that competitors often follow. That same dynamic is expected as Southwest looks to disrupt the business travel market. Bill Swellbar, chief industry analyst at Swellbar Zong Consultancy, warns that Southwest had better keep an eye on its flank as ultra-low-cost carriers such as Breeze and Avelo target leisure travelers in some of its markets. "Are they still hunters or are they the hunted, Swellbar says of Southwest. And finally, put the lotion in the basket. Momentum in leisure travel has been snowballing in recent months as wider distribution of COVID-19 vaccinations has helped unlock pent-up demand among Americans who long to get out of their houses. Translation, people are desperate for a vacation. Airlines have responded in kind by slashing traditional business routes and bulking up on flights to hot tourist locations in both the U.S. and Caribbean. By and large, that's been a boon for anyone with an itch to get to Florida. Of the net 52 million passenger seats added by airlines in the second quarter versus the trailing 3 months of 2020, approximately 1 in 6 had a Florida destination, according to Cirium, a provider of data and analytics for aviation and travel. Brett Snyder, an industry expert who runs the Cranky Flyer blog, predicts much of that shift will have some staying power as the pandemic subsides and Americans adjust to a more flexible work environment. I think there will be more people working remotely, he says. This means people can work in more places and get away more often. That weekend trip to Florida can sustain more service. And now we turn to the continuing series, The Promise of, the headline, Working to Fill a Need in Care. Nina Jacobs moved her child care business from Raleigh to Clayton. Now they come to her from all over the Triangle. Story by Connie Gentry. About this project, the project name is based on a historical reference relating to Union Army leader William Sherman's promise of giving 40 acres to slaves after the Civil War. That promise, which came to be known as 40 Acres and a Mule, never came through as President Andrew Johnson rescinded the order after taking office. Nina Jacobs is a woman of faith and a natural-born nurturer. Being an entrepreneur is further down the list. She opened her 24/7 child care center, Academy of Angels, to fill a void in a market where she saw the greatest need. That was in 2010 when she closed a child care center in Raleigh to start one in Clayton. God had a vision for me to provide child care for working mothers, she says. Raleigh had several other daycares that were trying to start what I was doing, so I felt the need was in a small area. Clayton was populated with hard-working families, many employed in 12-hour shift jobs, and in need of affordable 24/7 child care. I had a similar situation when I was a single mom, so I went through it myself and knew how important quality child care was to working parents, Jacob says. The need that existed before 2020 was magnified overnight with the onset of COVID. Closed schools and all but essential workers having to shelter at home. Many of those shift workers that her child care center had always supported were the essential workforce who found themselves needing child care more than ever. Compounding the challenges were the elevated protocols and processes for how a child care center could operate during the pandemic. Across the state, many child care facilities were forced to close. In April of last year, 43% of child care facilities were closed, and 30% of the child care centers in Johnston and Wake counties were closed, according to the Budget and Tax Center, a project of the North Carolina Justice Center. Jacobs kept her center open even when parents struggled and couldn't make payments, even when the cost of operations ballooned with the need for extra cleaning supplies, masks, thermometers, and PPE. We stayed open throughout, and I left it up to our employees if they wanted to stay or take off. All but one stayed, Jacobs says. It's important because we're providing child care for parents who are police, nurses, pharmacy workers, all kinds of essential jobs. Academy of Angels made changes to be able to operate in accordance with the requirements for sanitizing, social distancing, and limited contact. Children were dropped off to caregivers outside the facility, and parents were not allowed to come inside. Those practices continue even now. The hours of operation, once round the clock every day of the week, were cut back to 5 a.m. to 11 p.m., Monday through Friday. Before the pandemic, Jacobs Center typically enrolled 46 to 49 children. Across 2020, enrollment hovered between 36 and 40 children. Now it stands at 31 children. Dwindling enrollment and staff shortages remain problems throughout the state. Before COVID, 265,000 children were enrolled in North Carolina's child care facilities, and 41,000 teachers and staff were working in licensed centers. In April 2020, enrollment had plunged to 60,000 children statewide, and there were only 20,000 employees. By May of this year, the numbers had crept back up to 221,590 enrolled children and around 38,000 workers. It's hard to hire workers because my center doesn't have normal hours, like 8-to-5 jobs. I staff according to how many kids there will be at any given time, and that changes every week. Parents doing shift work don't always have the same shift, so they send me their schedule each week, and I create the staff schedule every Thursday for the following week, Jacob explains, adding that her staff's hours vary as well. With schools closed for several months and some parents still opting for remote learning, the after-school care became more complicated as well. Jacob stepped into the role of teacher, and her center has one or two students in each grade from kindergarten through fourth grade. Now, I'm the after-school teacher, and we've had 10 kids at 7 different schools. I wouldn't want to put anyone else on my staff through that. Each student had their own desk and had to wear their mask and stay 6 feet apart, she says. And she purchased 2 laptops in case students forgot to bring their school-issued laptop with them. Teachers sent their schedules, which Jacobs posted, for the students to follow. And she became the primary conduit between parents and the schools. In the coming school year, most of her parents plan for their students to return to in-person classes, so her after-school care will ideally return to pre-pandemic mode. Some of the biggest challenges have been maintaining the little details and securing supplies like milk when there were restrictions on the quantity of groceries that could be purchased. Jacobs was driving from one store to another almost daily to purchase food and drink. Even with reduced hours, the center serves 6 meals a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, plus morning, afternoon, and late-night snacks. And Jacobs or one of her staff prepare all of the food in-house. One day, I was at a Walmart with all this milk in my basket, and they said, "You can only get 2. I asked to see the manager. When I told him I ran a daycare, he let me get all I needed. Money was tight, despite getting 2 operational grants from the state, but Jacobs made it all work. "It was hard during COVID, but it was worth it for my parents. When there's a need, God gives you strength to provide, and he made a way for every need. Not one person on my staff missed making a payment, and neither did we," she says. In addition to serving Clayton, families come from Wendell, Knightdale, Raleigh, Selma, Greenville, and Fayetteville. "The biggest challenge going forward is for parents being able to pay for childcare," Jacobs adds. "If there is a struggle to pay, I work with my parents. I'm not going to have them take food off their table to pay, so we just have to make it work." About half of the children enrolled at Academy of Angels are on the state's subsidy program, but Jacobs finds fault with how the subsidy monies have been allocated across the state. "In Johnston County, we aren't paid enough for subsidy care," she says. In its current fiscal year, July through May, the state of North Carolina has paid $372 million to fund child care subsidies. Wake County received $45 million across those 11 months. Durham County received $17.4 million, and Johnston County received $6.4 million. Other rural counties came in even lower: Chatham, Edgecombe, Franklin, Granville, Harnett, Lee, Moore, Nash, and Person each received $1 million to $3 million. "I've never made a profit at the center," Jacobs notes. "Maybe one day I will, but now my profit is my parents and my children, making sure they meet their family needs and seeing them gain and move on." Her goals for the next year are to increase staff and enrollment. The center is licensed for 55 children. "Maybe I'll do another center in another area of need one day, but first I want to get back open on weekends. My staff likes this Monday to Friday schedule, but I look forward to going full force again." And there is one news article in the Promise Of section. Can entrepreneurs help one of Durham's poorest areas? Standing in Durham's Haytie community, arguably the poorest community in the city, it's hard to imagine the glory days of the early 20th century when there were more than 200 thriving black-owned businesses along Fayetteville, Pettigrew, and Pine Streets, and successful black entrepreneurs owned fine homes and lived well. Today, the Haytie community remains predominantly black, but overwhelmingly poverty-stricken. Depending on which section you're in, the Haytie population ranges from 77 to 96% black, and median incomes are $16,000 to $20,591. Henry McCoy Jr., director of entrepreneurship at the NC Central University School of Business and the director of Haytie Reborn, wants entrepreneurs to envision the community of the future, one that produces a renaissance of prosperity and opportunity in the historic neighborhood. "What we've seen is the continued growth of disinvestment over time," McCoy said at an event unveiling the Haytie Reborn project. "What precipitated the demise of the community was the development of Durham's highway system in the mid-60s. Not every black Wall Street was destroyed like Tulsa. The highway came through Haytie and destroyed families, firms, and institutions. Across the decades, Durham has progressively lost any semblance of racial equity. Today, the overall population is 40% white, 37.8% black. but 87.6% of paid employees are white versus 5.4% who are black. Through Haiti Reborn, McCoy says Durham can become a teaching city for communities across the world. We have to bring together public, private, and philanthropic communities. We need visionary leadership and reparative justice. And we have to rebuild the community's economic ecosystem. We have to create a place where equity matters and moves forward. Minority entrepreneurship must be connected to a broader vision for the overall community and marketplace. The United Way of the Greater Triangle joined McCoy at the announcement and is committing its resources and networks to support the Haiti Reborn Project. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Crowds pick up for artists. The pandemic was a brutal blow for the Triangle's artistic community, but optimism is returning as performances begin and patrons return to artist studios. In downtown Raleigh, sculptor Paris Alexander launched the City Market Artists Collective at 300 Blake Street in late 2019. The collective's 11 artists all had previous ties to nearby art space and brought an established base of clients. Alexander notes that the soft opening in February 2020 was fantastic, with a big crowd visiting the 2,500 square foot space. Everybody was like, this looks like it could really work, he says. But traffic evaporated as the pandemic hit, and then Alexander found himself scrambling to find a secure place for the art as Raleigh was rocked by riots after George Floyd's death. It got incredibly bad. Nobody was coming in, he says, and then, with some of the protests that were going on, it really exacerbated everything. But crowds are coming back as First Fridays, where downtown Raleigh's artist community throws open its doors for visitors, have helped. The collective includes established painters such as Eric McRae, Pam Shank, and Judy Crane, and has added an exhibition from popular local artist Bob Rankin. Alexander says traffic has been slowly ramping up for the last 3 months. The last two First Fridays, you see almost double the number of people coming in each time, he adds. It's still not what it was, but it's absolutely dramatically different. Eventually, Alexander sees the collective growing as a place where professional artists can thrive, using the platform to showcase their work and expanding the offering of classes and lectures. In that sense, I don't think we've even revved the engine, he says. Where do Tar Heels come from? Some fascinating numbers from Carolina Demography in Chapel Hill give a snapshot of how the state of North Carolina is growing. According to numbers it analyzed from the U.S. Census Bureau, nearly 361,000 people moved to the state in 2019. Topping the list of where those new people came from were Virginia, 37,837, Florida, 27,367, South Carolina, 26,306, New York, 22,655, Georgia, 18,916, and California, 18,738. The South Carolina numbers are remarkably high given the fact that the Palmetto State has half the population of North Carolina, but 31% of those coming from South Carolina were born in North Carolina. Of foreign countries, Honduras led the way with 5,700 immigrants in 2019, with India and Mexico each contributing 4,300 new North Carolinians. Love of outdoors becomes a business. Kit and Sonia Linton love adventures and have visited 29 national parks. Now they're planning a new adventure, a business of their own. Kit Linton left his job at IBM and is teaming with Sonia, a Durham attorney, to launch Firefly Adventures and feature outdoor clothing, gear, and itineraries, as well as a website and adventure app to guide users in their outdoor excursions. Plans also include an upscale coffee shop. The Littons bought an aging single-story property at 115 North Gregson Street in downtown Durham, planning to renovate and redevelop it into a two-story mixed-use building. Kit's brother, Kobe Linton, head of local firm Kobe Linton Architects, designed the space, and the group hopes to open next summer. We'll be taking our expertise with that and translating that into a company that will be enabling people to have these adventures, Kit Linton says. We also think this is the perfect moment for a business like this. A lot of people found their solace in getting outside a bit. I think the outdoor business is seeing a revival right now, she says. UNC grads plan IPO for a gambling firm. One of North Carolina's soon-to-be newest public companies is tinged Tar Heel blue. Gambling.com Group has filed papers to go public on the NASDAQ symbol under the symbol GAMB. The offering isn't yet effective, and as the firm said, it's subject to market conditions, and there can be no assurances as to whether or when the offering may be completed. Its U.S. operations are based in Charlotte, but it's the brainchild of UNC Chapel Hill entrepreneurs Charlie Gillespie, CEO, and Kevin McChrystal, Chief Operating Officer. Gillespie, whose LinkedIn profile says he lives in Ireland, describes himself as an internet entrepreneur with extensive experience in information technology, financial markets, and digital marketing. Brat Pack star makes waves in North Carolina. Andrew McCarthy, the Brat Pack star with Emilio Estevez, Rob Lowe, Demi Moore, Ali Sheedy, and others, made a stir on social media recently with his passion for Waffle House. McCarthy posted, "I just spent 3 days working on a film in rural North Carolina, and I ate at Waffle House 4 times. He posted a photo of the sign, but not enough to identify the location. And finally, NC Central freshmen offered help. 6 first-generation students are benefiting from a new partnership between NC Central University and the Renaissance Foundation. The incoming freshmen include Manuhe Abibi of Apex and Amari Taylor of Elon, and all received $4,000 as the university's 2021 Renaissance Scholars. Being in the first group of students to be selected as Renaissance Scholars is an honor and something I take pride in, Abibi says. As a first-generation student, it will have a tremendous impact on my academic success. The students had to be the first in their family to go to college, demonstrate financial need, and have at least a 3.0 grade point average. The scholarship can be renewed up to 4 years. And now we turn to the On Tech and Aviation page, written by Lauren Onasorge. She gets the nod for NCDEQ. Records hint at circular economy agenda for governor's pick. Governor Roy Cooper has nominated lobbyist Elizabeth Beiser as Secretary of the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality. And a look at her record hints at what her priorities would be: recycling, education, and the circular economy. Beiser, who wasn't available to comment, has had a slew of past roles, including at NCDEQ's predecessor agency and at the Raleigh office of law firm Brooks Pierce. Beiser also served as senior policy advisor for the Recycling Partnership, a national nonprofit whose website describes its mission as transforming recycling for good in towns, cities, and states all across America. But it's her most recent role as president of her own lobbying firm that may most closely hint at her NCDEQ priorities. Public filings outline Beiser's strategies lobbying agenda, which includes sustainable funding for recycling infrastructure, education, and recycling initiatives, and a priority on matters related to the circular economy. The circular economy is a buzz phrase used to describe a system aimed at eliminating waste, employing reuse, repair, and recycling in order to create a closed-loop system. Keith Harrison, CEO of the Recycling Partnership, says bipartisan concepts like that of the circular economy idea will give Beiser an edge in North Carolina. It's an example of a bipartisan program of how do we build an intuitive system that serves people and the planet. The work that Beiser has done with the Recycling Partnership extends past that concept, Harrison says. While at the partnership, Beiser has worked with major corporations such as Walmart, Dow Chemical, and Coca-Cola, working with them on pledges to improve recycling. She's led for us, really, the growth of the public-private partnership around recycling, getting companies and communities singing the same song, Harrison says. RDU's return to Paris is delayed again. The return of Delta Airlines' RDU to Paris flight has been pushed back again from September to October, an airline spokesperson confirmed, surprising travelers who saw their flights changed abruptly. The latest schedule load this weekend included pushing out RDU CDG to a tentative start date of October 5, spokesman Drake Castaneda says. Delta is not alone in pushing flights amid the ongoing pandemic. RDU's other transatlantic service, which is nonstop to London, has also been delayed multiple times. American Airlines is currently planning to bring it back at the end of October. In the meantime, RDU expects one of its busiest post-pandemic travel weekends for the July 4th holiday, with more than 224,000 travelers expected to fly through RDU between July 2nd and 8th. Photographer sues Raleigh Music Hall. A New York City-based photographer is suing a Raleigh concert venue, claiming it used her images in its advertisements without permission. In a six-page federal lawsuit filed recently, photographer Jacqueline Roman accuses Wolfpack Ventures, which does business as the Poorhouse Music Hall in Raleigh, of copyright infringement when it comes to a photograph of the band Agent Orange. Roman claims she discovered the photograph, which she had taken in 2010, on Poorhouse's event website. Roman never gave Poorhouse permission or authority to copy, distribute, or display the work at issue in this case, the lawsuit claims. Roman in the lawsuit claims she tried to notify Poorhouse, sending two letters earlier this year. To date, Poorhouse has not responded, she claimed. She is asking for a judge to force Poorhouse to pay her damages as well as its profits attributable to the infringement. Poorhouse owner Adam Lindstadt couldn't be reached for comment. And now we have a section called He Said It with a quote by Skillsoft CEO Jeff Tarr, whose firm bought out Carey's Global Knowledge and a SPAC-linked deal in a SPAC-linked deal that created Skillsoft, a new publicly traded company. One of the things we've seen with COVID is that location matters less in many ways, and so I'm not sure whether or not we'll add staff. It's not a decision that's been made, but we certainly plan to continue our major presence here. And finally, a big number, $5 million. That's how much Apex technology firm Trigger Mesh has closed on in outside capital. The debt raise, disclosed through a securities filing, is part of an overall $5.2 million funder, meaning there is about $230,000 left to raise. So far, eight investors have participated. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Caleb Harshberger. Big changes at Blue Ridge. New tower would help revitalize Blue Ridge Corridor. The North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services has unveiled plans for its new headquarters tower in Raleigh, and the corner of Blue Ridge and Reedy Creek Roads is set for some big changes. The plans call for a 10-story office tower with accompanying parking deck and a total of 480,920 square feet of office space. The property is situated on 34 acres of state-owned land at 3905 Reedy Creek Road across Blue Ridge Road from the North Carolina Museum of Art. The property currently hosts the state's Fleet Maintenance and Mail Service Center. As Raleigh has grown as a whole, the area along Blue Ridge Road south of UNC Rex Hospital has struggled to attract development despite its proximity to sites such as PNC Arena and the Carter Finley Stadium. The city has made promoting development in the area a priority. Representatives for the North Carolina Department of Administration, which acts as a business manager for state government, declined to comment on the project, citing the ongoing budget process. The new headquarters would feature enough room to relocate the Department of Health and Human Services, which is currently operating at Dorothea Dix Park. The city of Raleigh is in the early stages of redeveloping the park. The DHHS leases for its existing space at the park are set to expire in 2025 and 2040. The plans for the new headquarters come as the state continues to pursue a rezoning of the site to allow for the project. The current zoning allows just three stories of office development. Earlier this year, the state said it hoped to begin construction on the project by the end of 2021. The first NCDHHS employees are expected to move in to the new campus by 2025. The project has been in the works since 2015 when the state finalized the $52 million sale of Dix Park to the city of Raleigh and began considering what to do with DHHS. The state spent the next 3 years studying potential sites. North Carolina Mutual Building in Durham will see $10 million renovation. The new owner of the historic North Carolina Mutual Building in downtown Durham has kicked off a $10 million renovation program and unveiled a new name, Mutual Tower. Turnbridge Equities of New York bought the tower in October in a foreclosure auction and is working to renovate the lobby and the first floor and swap out the HVAC and other aging systems to better meet post-pandemic standards. "We've been replacing the mechanical system entirely," says Jason Davis, managing director of Turnbridge Equities. The improvements include a state-of-the-art HVAC system touting 100% fresh air, top-tier MERV 13 filtration and bipolar ionization technology. First-floor renovations include added retail space and additions to the outdoor plaza, including urban green space and seating. Turnbridge chose the new name to reference the building's history as the home of the historic Durham firm NC Mutual Life Insurance Company. The 14-story building was built in the late 1960s and was previously known as the Tower at Mutual Plaza. Turnbridge paid $37.2 million for the property, which had been in foreclosure, following the previous owner, an LLC made up of local investors, defaulted on payments. Upscale apartments sold for $48 million. New York-based Blue Rock recently paid $48.8 million for the 276-unit Windsor Falls Apartments, which equals more than $176,000 per unit. The property is situated on 12.3 acres at 1500 Sunbow Falls Lane, between Falls of Neuse Road and Old Wake Forest Road, next to Millbrook Magnet Elementary School and by a collection of retail centers, including the Food Lion-anchored Wake Forest Square Shopping Mall. The seller, New York-based Gamma Real Estate, paid $35.7 million for the property in 2017. Built in 1994, the property features a mix of 1-, 2-, and 3-bedroom units with monthly rental rates ranging from $1,082 at the low end to as high as $3,623 a month for larger units, according to Apartments.com. Epic Games seeks rezoning for HQ. Epic Games is moving ahead with forming plans to redevelop the site of the Cary Town Center into a new campus for its corporate headquarters. The video game and software developer is asking the town to rezone the property as a mixed-use district, allowing for up to 3.5 million square feet of office space, 75,000 square feet of commercial space, and a 200-room hotel. The proposed zoning change would allow buildings up to 12 stories in height at the tallest parts of the property. Epic Games bought the property, located between Cary Town Center Boulevard and Walnut Street, on December 31 for $95 million. And finally, a big number, 384. That's the number of apartments that Miami-based Related Group has planned for the Town Drive Apartments, a complex near the Triangle Town Center. It's the company's first project in the region as it expands into the Carolinas. Related Group expects the total cost of the project to be $80 million. Now we turn to the On Healthcare page, written by Sonia Warwick. The first headline, new approach has promise. Universal vaccine aims to prevent pandemics to come. Last year, Dr. David Martinez was walking to his office from his car, thinking about the global shutdown caused by the pandemic when a thought occurred to him. Wouldn't it be nice if this never happened again, if we could develop more universal coronavirus vaccines, says Martinez, a postdoctoral researcher at UNC Chapel Hill's Gilling School of Global Public Health. That thought became the starting point for a new mRNA vaccine that has the potential to not just protect against COVID-19 and its variants, but potentially other coronaviruses, such as the ones that led to the SARS outbreak in 2003 and the MERS outbreak in 2012. A preclinical study suggests the UNC vaccine might just be able to accomplish that goal. The way the Pfizer-BioNTech and Moderna mRNA vaccines work is by giving a vaccinated person's cells the instructions, or mRNA, to make the spike protein on the surface of the coronavirus that causes COVID-19, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The person's cells then begin making those proteins, triggering an immune response that generates antibodies, the same way a person's body would if they were naturally infected. What the UNC researchers, alongside researchers from Duke University and the University of Pennsylvania, did differently is to make a chimeric spike protein, fusing together pieces of more distant viruses into a single spike that is intended to expand the breadth of immune protection. We've really taken advantage of the fact that the spike protein of the COVID-19 virus and its cousins are really modular, Martinez says, meaning that you could just take out a piece and put another one from a closely related virus. Martinez says they built off research that was already known about the modularity of coronavirus spike proteins and honed it in on the success of the mRNA vaccines. This research is especially important because coronaviruses have shown the potential to cause a pandemic that can effectively shut down the world. And a vaccine like the one being developed by UNC and its partners could quickly be deployed to the site of a future outbreak, Martinez says. ECU Vidant Health to fully integrate health clinics. In the near future, you may be able to go to an East Carolina University health facility for medical treatment. Though they haven't decided on an official name, East Carolina University and Vidant Health have announced that the university will move toward full clinical integration with the health system. Part of that integration includes the appointment of Vidant Health CEO Dr. Michael Waldrum as the dean of ECU's Brody School of Medicine, effective July 1. He'll maintain his role as Vidant CEO. Vidant has appointed ECU Chancellor Philip Rogers and another executive from ECU to its board. It is not a purchase or a takeover on either side or a merger of assets, Waldron says. That transition should help the health system recruit and retain physicians in the eastern part of the state, he says. 2 years ago, things weren't going as well between Vidant Health and the University of North Carolina system. The UNC system filed a lawsuit against Vidant Health for trying to kick the system out of the Greenville Hospital's governance. The UNC system was involved in selecting the members of Vidant Medical Center's Board of Trustees. Raleigh University's Land of Partnership. NC State University and St. Augustine's University have made strides to strengthen the pipeline of talent in science, technology, engineering, math, and education. NC State's Keenan Fellows Program for Teacher Leadership received a Biogen Foundation grant for a STEM-focused pilot program for K-12 educators. St. Aug's will be working with Braven Environmental to offer students and staff research and internship opportunities at Braven's Zebulon facility. And in a section called He Said It, the quote is from Tom Rhodes, CEO of Spencer Health Solutions, which has been growing rapidly and has seen patient engagement with its platform stay above 90%. It's been such a journey for a while now, making sure we did the work to put ourselves in a position to be successful. After many years, I think we're finally in that position. And finally, a big number, 113.5%. That's how much Heat Biologics increased the square footage of its R&D facilities recently. The company says it signed a new lease to increase its ability to do preclinical studies by synthesizing its own antibodies, other drugs, and reagents in-house, along with expanding its vivarium. And now we turn to On Retail and Restaurants, written by Erica Wells. Restaurants seek payouts. Triangle Restaurants seek expedited review of insurance claims. A group of Triangle Restaurants is pushing for an expedited hearing to determine if their insurer must pay for COVID-related claims. In October, 16 restaurants won a victory when a judge ruled their insurer, Cincinnati Insurance Company, should honor their claims under business interruption policies related to the shutdowns brought on by the pandemic. Cincinnati Insurance appealed the ruling, and the case went to the North Carolina Court of Appeals. In response, Painter Law attorney Gagan Gupta, who is representing the restaurants, has filed a bypass petition to ask the state Supreme Court to grant immediate appellate review and bypass the state's appeals court. Gupta represents the restaurants of acclaimed chefs, including Matt Kelly, Georgios Bakatsias, Jay Median, and Laszlo Lukacsi. The case could have national implications as restaurants continue to fight legal battles against insurance companies over claims linked to the pandemic's devastating impact on the food industry. Because the fate of these 16 restaurants and numerous other businesses hangs in the balance, definitive and final review of this legal dispute from North Carolina's highest court is urgently required, Gupta wrote in an email. The restaurants in the case are Vin Rouge, Parizade, Matteo Bar de Tapas, Rosewater, Mothers and Sons Trattoria, St. James Seafood, Lucky's Delicatessen, Ben 54, City Kitchen, Village Burger, Nasher Cafe, Local 22, Kipos, Golden Fleece, Farm Table, and Gatehouse Tavern. Last fall, the Supreme Court judge in Durham County rejected Cincinnati Insurance's argument over what constitutes a physical loss under business interruption coverage. We continue to believe that the business interruption coverage under our policy in this case does not apply because there is no structural alteration to property, Steve Johnston, CEO of Cincinnati Insurance Company's parent, Cincinnati Financial Corporation, said in October. The prevailing view by courts around the country has been that economic loss alone doesn't qualify as direct physical damage or loss of property, which is the trigger for business interruption coverage. The petition seeks to clarify the definition, which has caused a significant uptick in litigation and could impact restaurants throughout North Carolina and the U.S., according to court documents in the case. Relative of the late Mama Dip to reopen eatery at the North Carolina Museum of History. Visitors to the North Carolina Museum of History in downtown Raleigh can get their fill of Southern food again now that a popular dining establishment has reopened. Sweet Tea and Cornbread Grill and Eatery is back in business in the museum after being closed for more than a year due to the pandemic. Owner Tanya Council opened the establishment in July 2019 after working at Mama Dip's kitchen in Chapel Hill. Her grandmother was the late Mildred Council, known as Mama Dip, who started the traditional Southern restaurant in 1976. Sweet Tea and Cornbread Grill and Eatery's menu includes barbecue, chicken salad, and sweet tea, and small bites such as fried green tomatoes, cornbread, and fried okra. Booming market for virtual events propels Durham Talent Agency. A Durham entertainment company is taking full advantage of the way virtual events took off in the pandemic, and it expects that momentum to continue even as in-person events resume. The global market for virtual events was valued at nearly $58 billion in 2019 and is expected to reach more than $700 billion in the next decade, according to an Allied Market Research report. Virtual events got All American Entertainment through some of its toughest months last year, and now the technology is propelling the company back to success. Chief Operating Officer Margot Dunnigan says, "Founded in 2002, All American Entertainment now has 32 employees and has booked more than $200 million in celebrity talent on behalf of thousands of clients around the world. Since 2021 began, 82% of the company's scheduled events have been virtual. In the last month, the ratio of virtual events to live events has been 2-1. People have embraced it and seen the value," Dunnigan says. "People will go back to in-person events for sure, but virtual events will be another offering that takes place concurrently." And in a section called She Said It, a quote from Mary Michelle Nidifer, owner of Raleigh's Style Finder Boutique, on expanding the store's online presence. "We show our goods on Facebook Live and sell them through an app. That has been a real game changer for us. We had a few months last year where the revenue from the live shows was more than we had been making the previous year in just brick and mortar." And finally, a big number, 2,965. That's the number of priority applicants for the U.S. Small Business Administration's Restaurant Revitalization Fund that were notified they would not receive previously approved funds because of lawsuits filed by business owners, according to the nation's Restaurant News. And now we turn to On Orange County, written by Rachel Crumpler. Betting big on books, brews, downtown Chapel Hill Book Cafe beats COVID, preps to expand. First-time business owners Jamie and Miranda Sanchez did not anticipate COVID-19 would disrupt their book cafe business 5 months after opening. They also did not expect the opportunity for expansion would come this soon. But that's exactly what happened. The couple opened Epilogue Books, Chocolate Brews, an independent bookstore and Spanish-style chocolateria in November 2019 at 109 East Franklin Street, Suite 100, a 3,600 square foot space. And by September, after construction is complete, they plan to expand right next door into Suite 101, adding 2,200 square feet of space. Jamie Sanchez says the spaces will be connected, but they will be differentiated in name to distinguish the concepts. Epilogue will continue to be the cafe and new book space, while Prologue will house used, rare, and collectible books alongside additional cafe seating. Prologue will also feature a private room that can be rented for events, classes, and office hours for university professors. We're making a bet on the community that supported us during the pandemic, Sanchez says. We're investing more in them and in us. The expansion will require a $25,000 investment to add shelf and seating capacity, he says. The amount is significantly smaller than the initial investment cost of almost $600,000 to open Epilogue. In April 2020, Epilogue was approved for a $63,300 loan through the Federal Payroll Protection Program, according to data from the U.S. Small Business Administration. Book sales increased during the pandemic, Sanchez says. Prior to the pandemic, he says the cafe accounted for about 80% of revenue and books the other 20%. Now, book sales bring in about 40% of revenue. Part of that increase stems from Epilogue putting in the infrastructure for online book sales, which became the source of nearly all revenue for months. With the pandemic receding and UNC students returning this fall, Sanchez says having an additional 50 or 60 seats will help meet the demand he expects. Students found a good space here to study and hang out, and locals found a good space that's not a restaurant to come and relax, which is what we wanted, Sanchez says. Epilogue's pre-pandemic average monthly revenue was $70,000 to $80,000, and it was on track to make $1 million their first year, Sanchez says. Alliance forms to empower black businesses in Chapel Hill, Carrboro. Entering the Chapel Hill business scene was challenging for Kevin Kays Thomas, especially as a black business owner. After he opened his music studio, Vibe House, he felt he was treated differently. Multiple times, Thomas says people tried to cancel his lease or take it over by paying more than he could. And due to time, we'll have to stop reading the article here, but a potential solution has arrived with the new Black Business Alliance, a product of black business leaders working with the Chamber for a Greater Chapel Hill, Carrboro. The group recently met for the first time with 25 attendees. And we will have to stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. 5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.